CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, we'll be bringing you a live interview with two of the activists from the recent Olympic torch protest in Victoria, speaking about the protest and their particular concerns with the upcoming Games. We'll also be speaking to Steve Anderson, a coordinator for Canadians for Democratic Media and a TAI contributor. We spoke with him about the importance of media democracy and what that means in Vancouver. Finally, our own Richard Kemick brings us a piece on the film The Case for Israel, which was shown on campus last Monday. He also spoke with some pro-Palestine campus activists about their reaction to the screening. We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. This evening, we have the pleasure of having Emily Hopkins and Gregory Williams in studio with us. They're two activists who recently participated in a protest against the Olympics, converging around the Olympic torch as it passed through Victoria on October 30th. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
So I was wondering if you would just briefly describe what the protest was like, how many people were there, what types of things people brought with them, what the general atmosphere was like.
We showed up around 2 o'clock in the afternoon at Centennial, or Spirit Square, I guess it's called, in Victoria. And it's the same weekend as Halloween, so lots of costumes. Pretty festive environment overall. And so there were a bunch of legal observers and a bunch of cops, and then the protesters. I don't know, how many would you say?
Few hundred, 200, 300 maybe.
Okay. And so the idea of it was the five-ring circus was the sort of overall theme of the beginning part. And so there was like a band and various different activities and different songs that groups had sung with lyrics relating to some of their concerns around the Olympics. And Food Not Bombs provided food for it. And Harm Reduction Victoria had a table set up as well.
Yeah. And the theme was generally very, very festive. It was the main thing that brought the entire event together was the idea of presenting a positive vision as an alternative to the Olympics. So the five ring circus was, on the one hand, it was a caricature of the games, but it also was a real thing that they had set up with sports that were going on in the square, cycling, wrestling, even a competition for collecting cans, that just was trying to present an alternative to the big, you know, corporate-sponsored media stuff. And they just, the big message of the protest was, hey, we managed to have all this fun out here today for about $1,000, and the games are doing all this stuff for a much higher price, and in the process taking away from other much-needed priorities in the city, housing, harm reduction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you find that you were able to attract a lot of participants from, you know, onlookers or the community at large?
Not so much from the onlookers, but I would say, first of all, there was a sizable portion of people from Vancouver who managed to get over there. So the and I can say just from experience, the promotion over here was pretty good. There weren't actually that many onlookers around, though I definitely think that they would have come in and participated had they been there, because I can say from experience it was a lot of fun. So I think it was more just the lack of surrounding people than it was an unappealing event.
Plus, we had to go before the zombie march that evening, which sort of actually went through the town and might have attracted more general population, because this was sort of more set off from the actual area where the zombie march went through later.
So the Legal Observer Program, these are people with the BC Civil Liberties Association?
Yeah, bright orange shirts, yep.
Yeah. How did you have any thoughts on how that worked out, or interactions with police? Did you see anything? Can you say anything about that?
It seemed fairly all right overall. A few times the police were thanked for coming out by the organizers of the event, which was kind of neat to see, just because the challenge is always making it the actual issues of poverty and environmental degradation that are the problem, as opposed to just getting mad at the police and getting mad at all the authorities. And so that you can draw in people who think the Olympic Games are fun, right? Like, we stayed at a family friend's house, and, you know, some of her friends were, like, running in the torch relay, and so just trying to be able to talk to people who are participating on both sides of it. So having a kind of atmosphere where they're thanking the police for being there, because the police are doing their jobs, and we didn't see anything in particular that would have stepped outside that, at least for the part we were there.
Within trying to create a positive sort of protest, I guess, were there any specific issues that some of the activists were trying to raise attention about?
The two biggest issues, I think, and these were mostly just because this is like, these are big local issues in Victoria right now. The first major one was definitely harm reduction, just because Victoria has recently had its only permanent harm reduction site closed down, and they've changed over to a van, and this has not been good. So now, instead of having a set site to do care for addicts, needle exchange, things of that nature, they've got to go around the city in this tiny van that's doesn't actually have enough and isn't really equipped to go to people. So that was one huge issue, and just the matter of how the budget for the games has taken away from programs like that. And the second thing is the issue of the recent law that was passed saying that the police could, under certain circumstances that are actually very vague in the law, that the police could actually force a homeless person into a shelter, and that this was dehumanizing to them. And so then just also expanding from that around to issues of poverty and economic justice in general, as well as all the other environmental native land claims issues. But those were the two really central issues that the protests seemed to focus around.
Did you find that most of the protesters were using the upcoming Olympics as a vehicle to air prior complaints or complaints that are only tangentially related to the games? Or were most of the protesters directly protesting the Olympics?
I would say because it was specifically the torch relay that weekend, that there was definitely a focus towards the Olympics specifically. A lot of the slogans on the signs were pretty Olympics related. But in some ways, the Olympics is just an augmentation of stuff that's going on at the rest of the time in society as well, in terms of money being diverted from these sorts of things, and it just happens at a more extreme level with the Olympics. So it sort of makes sense also that, like, Harm Reduction Victoria would be having a table there and that sort of thing.
There's also is the fact that the Olympics is a prime example of the kind of society that we're living in, and is kind of, I guess, a diagnostic tool that the activists were using to show, see, here, look at this, look at how many billions of dollars we're spending on this while there are people on the streets, as a way of illustrating and exemplifying these larger issues in society. Because let's face it, if it really were just about issues with the Olympics, these protests would be kind of irrelevant, because the Olympics are going to be over in a couple months. And protesting them right now is not really going to do much about what the Olympics have already done in the city. It's horrible. But what this is really going to do is try to target some of these more long-term systemic issues, of which the Olympics are a part, but which will still be here and will still be relevant after the games are over.
So you would say that these protests are more using the Olympics as a metaphor for the way that they fear our society is changing, or a direction that they feel our society is tending towards?
Well, not just a metaphor, because a metaphor implies that the games or whatever is being used for the metaphor are not part of the thing itself, rather that they're just an image. The Olympics are not just an image of inequality in our society. They also embody that inequality itself, because the money that is being spent on the Olympics is real money. The programs that have been cut so that the Olympics can be brought here are real programs. The 1,000 people or more that have been put on the street because Olympic construction has destroyed more than 800 units of low-income housing in the city of Vancouver since the games were, quote, won, unquote, are real people. So it's definitely not just a metaphor, but it is certainly drawing the link between the games and all these other long-term issues.
What would you say to people who focus on the games or who view the games as a really positive image of hope, of athletic achievement, of countries joining together? What would you say to people?
To be honest, that's been part of why we went out to this protest, just to try and get a feel for it, as well as planning other future protests in Vancouver going up to it, just because a lot of the people who believe those things, and they're not necessarily wrong. It's just a matter of not actually knowing about the other things as well, and trying to come at an angle where we can talk to people without alienating them completely by, you know, oh, you're stupid, you don't know about the poverty issues, you're just caught up in the corporate whatever, right? And so part of it was going to try and figure out how better to articulate our stance on the position, because that's been really challenging. Because I think it's not totally fair to say, oh, that all of it has been invalidated by these other issues, but I do think it seriously undermines the community building aspect when huge portions of our society get swept away because of it. It's like, for which part of society is it those things?
So talk about the Olympic activist sort of movement in Vancouver more generally. Do you think that it has been informed or is related to other sort of anti-globalization protests around the world? Do you see any connection, or do you feel like it's very specific to Vancouver and to the Olympics?
I wouldn't say it's specific to Vancouver at all, just because if you look at, for example, the recent bid by Chicago for the Games. Chicago largely lost that bid. Again, quote, lost, unquote, because is it really that much of a loss if you don't have the Olympics in your city? Well, that's what the issue's all about. But the Chicago mostly lost the bid because there was a huge movement in Chicago against the Games. That was actually largely influenced by Vancouver. And whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, because of course there's the argument that, well, if we push the Olympics out of these developed democracies, it'll just go into developing countries and dictatorships and it'll just get worse. But regardless of that, there is definitely a global link here, because the Olympics are a global phenomenon and they are a phenomenon that continues to exemplify these large-scale inequalities in our society pretty much no matter where they go. And so the anti-Olympic movement in Vancouver is part of a global movement against the Olympics, and also part of which itself is part of a movement against these broader problems. So I wouldn't say it's isolated at all.
I've also heard talk that a lot of people worry that with the bylaws that are being passed, that they're going to be used again I believe Vancouver's hosting the G8 later this year. Do you see it within that context as well, in terms of the city?
In the sense that civil liberties is a constant battle in any democracy, yes. Every time there's a big, I don't want to say conflict, but a big thing with surrounding activism in the city, it always sets a precedent. We're still talking about APEC. So I will not be surprised. And what happened at APEC is still, you know, several years ago, is still influencing our thinking today. I have no doubt that the Olympics is going to continue to influence what we're saying and what we're thinking about activism and how the city is acting for years to come. So it's an important precedent, yes.
Plus, the trick with a lot of the bylaws that were passed, like back in August, is that, you know, there's wording on part of it that's like, these are temporary measures for the Olympics, and then later on in the actual bylaws specifically, it's like, except they might last forever. And they're just sort of changing so quickly over time that it's really hard to keep track of what the state of civil liberties will be at the end of all this.
Great, thanks. Any final thoughts from either of you?
One of the highlights of the protest would have to be the giant salmon mascot that was being eaten away at by the
Sea lice,
yes, that's the word. Just the environmental degradation as well as the First Nations thing and this giant salmon, it was kind of awesome.
It was several people long. It was awesome.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
It's now time for a break, but stay tuned. We'll have more campus and local news after some public service announcements.
Each and every radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Up
leave, but survive for a reason to tell my story to touch life.
Hip-hop artist Emmanuel Jal, once a child soldier in Sudan, has returned to his home country, and this time his weapon is a microphone. His unique story and effort to build peace, War Child, is just one of the 25 films featured this year at the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Me, I got a reason for being on this earth, cause I know more than many water. Life is worth better. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds.
This boy and girl coming home from school look quite content with life. And why not? They're looking forward to an important date. Dinner at home with the family. What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
Luckily, UBC students have lots of on-campus dining options.
Bernoulli's Bagels, serving up authentic Montreal-style bagels made fresh daily on the premises, in addition to sandwiches, soups, squealers, calzones, and freshly squeezed juice. Bernoulli's is located on the main concourse of the sub and open Monday through Saturday. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. This afternoon, our own Megan Turcotto spoke with Steve Anderson, a coordinator with Canadians for Democratic Media and a contributor to the TAI. They spoke about the upcoming Media Democracy Day and the importance of independent media here in Vancouver.
Okay, so first of all, what is Media Democracy Day for those who haven't heard of it?
So one day... public forum on media and communications issues in general, and the idea is to educate people about what's going on in media, media concentration, and internet issues, and to encourage people to get involved and engage in those issues and to kind of take action on them.
So why is media democracy necessary? What shortcomings do you see in the way Canadian media is currently organized?
Well, there's a lot of issues that come up. I mean, but one is that traditional media is very concentrated in Canada. BC is a great example. CanWest, one outlet that has a pretty conservative bias, owns most of the local media in Vancouver. They own the Daily. They own which is Vancouver Sun. They own the Province. They own the National Post, as well as TV and radio. So that's problematic, having one fairly conservative outlet control that much of our media. So that's one of the issues that comes up. And then on the flip side of that is there's also independent and community and campus media that is sort of trying to, you know, breathe new energy into dialogue and debate. And they're usually struggling to reach a larger audience. So Media Democracy Day... a big part of the day is kind of trying to figure out how to support independent media, find out about new independent media projects, and like figure out ways to like align them better and to promote them and get them more exposure. So those are two really big issues. And more recently, there's been a bit more of a focus on internet issues. For example, the issue of net neutrality. I'll be doing a workshop on that, and basically the issue is the internet service providers are trying to take control of the internet. They're trying to decide which internet services we have access to. So they're kind of trying to become gatekeepers of the internet.
So the internet is a platform for people to overcome this media concentration, but can you maybe speak to a bit about what sources or services we're in danger of losing should the net not remain neutral?
Probably the best example of kind of how this can happen was in 2003. The TELUS union was striking, and TELUS didn't want them to have a voice, so they completely blocked their website. So they have the power to do that. They have the same technology that the government in Iran and China have to censor us, but they do it for commercial interest rather than for government interest. That's one example. Another one is they slow down access to BitTorrent technology, which a lot of people use for sharing and distributing videos, and that's already happening. And this is like one of the most radically democratic technologies on the internet. So again, this is a technology that is used a lot by independent media, and that's being stifled and slowed down. So in terms of the future, what they're pushing towards is having a two-tiered internet. So if you have a lot of money, like Can West, for example, you can buy into like a fast lane internet. You know, it's like TV, like it works really well. And if you're not, if you're an independent media group or an individual, you have to go on the slow lane internet to get your content out, which no one will want to use. So it's a little bit more like, community TV, where you only have, a little bit more like TV, where the community TV station has, the really weird hours on the Shaw station, and that's really all they have access to, whereas the big corporations have all the rest of the television medium. So that's the kind of model they're moving us towards.
It's my understanding that the CRTC is currently reviewing how companies use the web and regulate the web themselves, basically.
Yep.
Do you have any insight of what's come out of that?
Yeah, I went to the CRTC traffic management hearing in the summer, and I testified before them at that. And they just had a ruling on that, and what they decided was that that these internet service providers should not slow down access to technologies unless they have no other option. So, for example, if the internet is like way too congested and they have no other option, like they just like have to deal with it, then they can slow down certain technologies. So the problem with this is that they're not enforcing it yet, and they're basically putting it on people like myself, because I run a coalition called SaveOurNet.ca that works on this issue. And they're basically putting it to us to prove the case. So, it's a step forward because they put out like a framework for net neutrality. The ISPs are still controlling the medium and slowing down things. We have to basically lodge a well evidenced complaint to the CRTC proving that this activity is not necessary. So, in a nutshell, they took a small step in the right direction, and we need to push that small step into a big step.
So if we go back to the TELUS example you were speaking of earlier, what happened with that? Was there any enforcement of TELUS blocking the website created by their striking workers?
Yeah, they were basically told that they can't do that. So that's the worst example, and I don't think you're going to see them. You're going to see ISPs outright blocking websites because they sort of learned that lesson that people get very upset when they do that. So what you're going to see is much more subtle. It's just that when you're using the internet, every now and then it doesn't work very well and you don't know why, and sometimes it's just like your connection. But that's the kind of thing that will happen is that when you're using BitTorrent, for example, technologies, if you're trying to, the CBC was using it, so people would go and try and download CBC videos, that it would like take a day to download, and people would just give up on it. No one knew why, right? Like they just were like, "Oh, I guess this video takes forever. Oh well, forget it." But it turns out Bell Canada was actually slowing down access to that video. So that's the kind of thing, and that's what makes it scary, is that it's not very easy to tell, because it's just people just assume that there's something wrong with the internet in general, but really what's happening is your ISP is deciding for you that what you're trying to get, you shouldn't get.
So has there been any movement towards oversight of, I guess, how companies regulate access to the media?
The organization I work with is called SaveOurNet.ca, and that's pretty much what we're calling for, is for the CRTC to have oversight and for them to firmly enforce net neutrality to prevent this thing from happening. And, like I was saying earlier, they have made steps in the right direction, but now we have to basically push forward and force them to enforce these rules. We just launched a campaign targeting Tony Clement, who's the industry minister, and we're basically telling him to demand the CRTC do regular audits of ISPs. So I don't have to go and search out every single thing an ISP is doing and lodge complaints, because that's going to take a while. What we're saying is that the CRTC should every month or two, do an audit of what the ISVs are doing themselves, and then tell them to stop whatever they're doing that's wrong, because I think that makes more sense in terms of enforcement. So if people are interested in this issue, I do encourage people to go to saveournet.ca and send Tony Clement a letter telling him you like the internet.
What kind of sense do you get about how aware the general public is of the limitations of the media they're consuming?
My experience is that people know that there's limitations. Like, I don't think they know much about this, like, net neutrality issue. I think, you know, that there's definitely been a movement for it, but a lot of the general public is still unaware, and that's something that, you know, I in particular need to fix, and that's one of the reasons why Media Democracy Day is important. But in terms of general media and journalism and stuff, I think the public, from my experience, is pretty well aware that it's not serving our democratic needs in this society. That, you know, they know that, like, there's, like, you know, people are just rewriting press releases, and that there's less and less journalists working, and that the media, a lot of it's like fluff, and you know, it's heavily influenced by commercial interests. Like, I think that that's almost common wisdom at this point, which is part of the reason why it looks like there is a bit of a, you know, despite the economic slowdown and everything, there does seem to be increasing support for, you know, the Tai and Rabble and community radio and independent media in general. So my main, you know, one of the reasons I want to work on these issues is because I think this is actually a really exciting time. We have the traditional, you know, corporate media basically in crisis, and we have more and more people aware that they're not serving their needs. At the same time, we have an open internet that we can, or we still have sort of an open internet that we can use to launch exciting projects and to raise awareness. So it, to me, like, this is a critical juncture that we can completely change the media and you know, make it more democratic, really, in the next couple of years if we take it seriously.
Do you feel as though traditional media models such as CanWest are failing, not because of their structure, but because people are, I guess, wise to it and understand that they're not getting a full range of views here?
I think it's a combination. I think, you know, that there's definitely been a lot of, you know, there's a lot of communications and media literacy programs out there, and you know, that I'm partly the product of those. So I think those are definitely having an impact. And more people are wise to these, to, like, the agenda of corporate media, I guess. But so that's one factor. But I think other factors are that the CRTC has failed to keep big media in check, and they've basically taken themselves down by they own so much media that they are so anti-competitive, and that they're so homogenous that, you know, when independent media comes out and starts putting interesting stories out there, they really have nowhere to go, and they've just, like, cut their journalism so much, and, like, that they have such a greed and hunger for profit that it's just completely eroding their credibility as a source of information. So I think that it's a combination of those, of basically the big business corporate greed eating the media, basically, people getting wise and educated about it and just not paying attention to them anymore, and then there's the online, the internet, is that it just provides an opportunity, an easy opportunity for us to escape big media. I mean, before the internet, it was much more difficult.
So if listeners do want to celebrate independent media or learn more about the current system, what can they do? How can they participate in Media Democracy Day?
Yeah, definitely go to Media Democracy Day this Saturday. It's just at 11 a.m. and goes till 6. And we have guest speakers like Rafe Mayer, who ran a big environmental campaign and was kind of shut down by the media. And he also writes for the Tai. And then we have a greenwashing campaign. It's gonna be, a panel that'll be really interesting. And we also have Donald Gutstein, who just wrote a book about corporate propaganda. And we also have we have this exciting artist, Fabiana from San Francisco, who basically is world renowned for creating social movement graphics and designs, and she's going to talk close out the day, which is going to be really exciting. I think anyone who cares about these issues and wants to kind of move the ball forward on this, you know, it's like the perfect thing to kind of get engaged. In terms of moving beyond that, I would check out the website, openmedia.ca, which is an organization I work with that kind of works on campaigns for independent media and net neutrality and things like that.
Okay, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you a piece on the recent screening of the film The Case for Israel at UBC, right after these public service announcements.
UBC Film Society.
The Norm Theater, located in the sub-main concourse, plays the hottest films Wednesday through Sunday. Go to UBCFilmSociety.com for full scheduling information.
Sign up for a membership at The Norm and receive half price off admission and benefits.
Check out the Film Sock Facebook group for more info.
Film Sock? I think so.
The AIDS Vancouver helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
First learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website www.spec.bc.ca for more information.
Hey, we're J+J+J, and I bet you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The sitar?
We call it that. Do you?
You should. Unless you don't like sitars.
Welcome back to News 101. The current time is 5:31. This week, our own Richard Kemick attended the screening of The Case for Israel, a film which has been called a must-see pro-Israel film. Richard discusses the film and interviews two on-campus activists on both sides of the issue.
Thanks, Carrie. This past Wednesday, The Case for Israel, the movie by Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor and New York Times bestseller, was shown at the UBC. The film is divided into several segments, such as history and justice and so forth, each one arguing for not only the existence of a Jewish state, but the essential need for Israel itself. The movie begins in direct response to former American President Jimmy Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Soon enough, however, the case for Israel widens its scope to take on numerous other opponents of Israel. The film draws on prominent Israeli politicians to argue their points as well by interviewing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and opposition leader Tzipi Livni. I had the chance to sit down with the vice president of the Israel Awareness Group, Josh Markowitz, and get his thoughts on the film. I'm with Julian from Israel Awareness Club in the SU building. So we just saw the movie. In watching it, there was a lack of Palestinian voice in the movie. Now, before the movie was addressed, it was about to show Israel beyond the Palestinian conflict. Does the Palestinian voice in Israel only extend to the conflict with Israel?
Israel's a liberal democracy, and we're incredibly proud of Israel's record of freedom for all of its citizens, Arab, Druze, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. In fact, one of the people that attended this movie, a close friend of mine, is a Taiwanese gentleman who resided in Israel for some time, and he was very pleased with the movie. It's the first time he'd seen it. The notion that Israel is free for all of its citizens, and I think Mr. Dershowitz addressed this in the film, that Israel being a Jewish state means that it's a moral state for everyone.
Does the Israel Awareness Club support the two-state solution?
So the Israel Awareness Club supports democracy, and that's where we stop politically. We embrace a number of political views. You know, we don't. There is no monolithic political view of the Israel Awareness Club. There are people with a diversity of views, and in fact, we dedicate a portion of every meeting to discussing those views and to drawing out those opinions, so that we can have a productive dialogue.
Did you formally invite the Palestinian Human Rights Group to the showing?
There were no formal invitations made to any clubs. We do work with a number of clubs on campus. None of them were invited because they would have been unnecessary. Everyone was invited, whether a club member, not a club member, not affiliated with any institution. Everyone was invited to this event. With regard to the Palestinian club on campus, we have a separate initiative that we started a little while back to create a dialogue, a really productive dialogue with them, and that's running in parallel to our general community outreach events.
In the movie, there's a quote by Mr. Dershowitz saying, Israel is a Jewish state the same way Canada is a Canadian state. However, Israel is not a Jewish state in the same way Arab countries are Muslim states. Can you expand on this and the meaning behind that?
Israel is not a theocracy by any means. It's a liberal democracy. And it's a nation state. The Jewish people are a nation, and Israel is their state. In the same way that the Canadian people are a nation, the French people, the Polish people, indeed the Chinese people, and each of those distinct nations has a state, and this is a concept that is core to the United Nations, that every nation should have a state. It's not, without speaking to any other states in the region, because I'm not experts in those areas, Israel is not a theocracy. It's religiously free, religiously pluralistic, and people of all faiths. In fact, I'll use the example of the Baha'is. I know some Baha'is on campus, and I've had some interesting discussions with them. The Baha'i World Headquarters is actually located in Israel, the Universal House of Justice, and the Baha'is thoroughly enjoy the relationship with the Jewish state.
In the movie, it is discussed quite extensively Israel's higher sense of morality comparatively with the neighboring countries around Israel. And then furthermore, it is also discussed how it's perceived that the UN overly criticizes Israel. Do you think this is the UN holding Israel to the same sense of morality in which Israelis allegedly hold their own country to?
There are two separate issues that need to be addressed. One is that of international law, which is consistent for all countries and should be consistently applied everywhere. The other is of individual morality, the Jewish morality, which underlies a great deal of Israeli law, the Israeli founding principles, the principles of the IDF, is one of moral scrutiny, is incredibly high. I'm loath to compare it to that of other nations because I can't speak to that as confidently, but I can say that Jewish morality and the morality that underlies the Jewish state is very rigorous. The Israeli Defense Force is an ethical army, the most ethical in the world, and it holds itself to those high standards.
Do you think that the movie fairly and unbiasedly portrayed the Israeli conflict with Palestine, the Palestinian conflict with Israel, and the two separate states?
The film was an academic exposition of Israel. The case for Israel was divided, as you saw, into separate areas, into separate arguments for the importance of the Israeli state, for its moral operations in the world, and I think it critically addressed the world's response to Israel.
Thank you to Julian for that interview. And moments ago, I also had the opportunity to sit down with Omar Shaban, the president of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, UBC, to get his thoughts on the issue as well. So I'm here with Omar Shaban of the Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights Group. Omar, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question is, were you able to see the movie The Case for Israel?
No, I was not able to see the movie. But I did read the book, The Case for Israel. And it's an interesting book. The viewpoint that Dershowitz presents is very interesting. I don't agree with any of what he says, but it remains a viewpoint. It is something that I would expect from Alan Dershowitz, given, you know, his upbringing and, you know, Zionist mentality. To me, he's a person who is not willing to accept the other point of view as legitimate. He distorts history for his own political agenda. It is clear that he selects bits and pieces from history instead of, you know, providing the overall picture.
Can you give more examples of Mr. Dershowitz doing that?
Well, there's a point, actually, my favorite, discussion about the book happened between Finkelstein and Dershowitz in the famous debate. And Finkelstein outlines, perhaps, 25 times better than me, the main mistakes in the book. And one of the most important, mistakes in the book is the sources that he selects. Very non-academic, right? Which is something that you wouldn't expect from an academic like Alan Dershowitz. Some of the numbers he puts in the books, he wasn't even able to defend his viewpoint. Like, there was a point where he puts the wrong number about the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from a certain village, and when Finkelstein asked him about that, he didn't have an answer. There is, like, some of the sources were absurd, as like Sony Pictures or something like that. You know, highly, to me, it's a, you know, very biased, very selective.
In my interview with Julian earlier on this week, he had mentioned that the initiative of setting up a dialogue between the Israel Awareness Group and the Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights Group. Has there been any movement on this?
It's interesting that he mentions that. In fall of last year, we did invite the Israeli club to have a debate on campus, an academic debate, and we said we will have Norman Finkelstein, very outspoken political scientist on the issue, and they can have anybody, you know, they wish to have, ranging, you know, Alan Dershowitz or whoever. And they initially, they didn't respond, they didn't reject, but afterwards they said, no, we're not going to debate Norman Finkelstein, because according to them, they don't want to legitimize his point of view. Of course, you know, it's not up to them to say whether his point of view is wrong or right. You know, he is a widely acclaimed academic. He has a PhD. He wrote several books. And, you know, his facts are not disputed even by his main enemies. But yeah, that's an initiative we provided, and that's an initiative they rejected. Later on, they did invite us over hummus and argila. Of course, we said we're not really interested in this type of dialogue.
In the film, Mr. Dershowitz makes the statement that most Israeli citizens are pro-Israeli, but then also pro-Palestinian, being in favor of the two-state solution. He then, however, goes on to say that most people that are pro-Palestine are not pro-Israel. Do you agree with this? What are your thoughts on this sentence?
It's interesting that he makes this us versus them dichotomy. To us, as a human rights club, there's no us and them. There's human rights. There is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, United Nations resolutions, and international law. The convention, you know, relating to the status of refugees, relating to the status of stateless persons, you know, regarding, you know, the suppression and punishment of the crime of apartheid, and so on and so forth. And that's our framework of analysis. Anybody who's against us is a person who's against international law. If you are with international law, then you're with us. Right? To me, there's nothing called pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian. Right? I'm pro-human rights, pro the implementation of human rights, and pro-justice. Anything that's, again, outside the realm of international law is unacceptable. Right? I'm not going to sit down and, you know, discuss, you know, the romantic views of fairness and justice and all that outside the realm of international law.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you very much for coming in, Omar. It was a pleasure to see you.
All right, thank you very much.
So thanks again to the Israel Awareness Group and Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights for giving me both these interviews on those various topics. Carrie, back to you.
Thanks, Richard. And now in studio with us, we have Yassine Karaga, who has come, he's a student here at UBC from Burundi. He's come part of the WUSC organization program. He's also a project manager of WUSC. He's here to talk to us about the organization, its history, and what it does.
Thank you very much, yes, to give me this opportunity to talk about, to give the biography of WUSC, World University Service of Canada, what it's doing here, and what so far its objective, and what I've already done so far. First of all, WUSC started as an amalgamation of different European countries, West and Asian countries after the Second World War in 1945 to discuss about how they could sponsor and help students from different countries which was just affected by the war. Around 1976, most countries withdrew their hands from the program, and Canada, it realized that there are still more needs durable assistance to assist those students as well as people whom affected by the war. It's just globally students from different countries such as Sri Lanka, India, African, near most all African countries, as well as Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and Iran. So the contribution so far, there is no right, just clear contribution from the government. It's just the contribution of Canadian university students who contribute around $2.5 Canadian just to they bring together money and then send them to those countries which they work together with the citizenship and the immigration Canada plus the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to ensure that those students they could get any durable assistance. So far, since 2006, through Canadian Students Association from different universities, they have attained their objectives. They have promoted a number of different students here in Canada. Some now they are lawyers. For example, in currently there is one of the Christine who's graduated as a lawyer from University of British Columbia. She's now working with the Citizenship and the Immigration Canada. She's a human rights lawyer. There is another Ugandan lawyer who's called Margaret Akria. She was a graduate from University of British Columbia. She's a lawyer and working in downtown with the Africa Canada Development Agency. She has established different projects. She arrived here in 1987. There are different students who have already graduated as medical practitioners, university lecturers, as well as into different professionals. Still, because Canada, its objective that to assist, they endeavor to assist till they realize that everyone has the right for education, they still provide contributing through their Canadian students ensure that students from different countries around the world, they could at least enjoy the rights of education. Currently, I'm a new student here at UBC from Burundi. I'm doing my second year here. I arrived here in August this year, and I'm part of OSCA. I came with different students around whom I met here at UBC. Some they came from Botswana, some came from South Africa, some came from Namibia, Ivory Coast, and the largest population is from Darfur, Sudan. There are different nationalities, for example, in Rwanda during the genocide, 1994. Most students lost their family members and they had no chance to join the rights for education. They went into refugee camps where they have been receiving assistance through the government of Canada from Canadian students' contributions. So far, there are still more needs, which we may appeal for all Canadians to come up to assist with any slight, just small contribution to ensure that those who left should be maybe assisted in other ways. USCA provide other objectives as other development projects apart from educating the students, like tailoring institutions, training people, those who are in a refugee camp, HIV, AIDS, plus other projects. So we may appeal any assistance which may be around to assist. Yeah.
Great. And so for people who are coming into Canada as refugees, they're provided with citizenship, correct? And support, tuition, everything, so that they can be success?
Yeah, Yes, the first example is myself. Recently, 2 days ago, I've been granted a permanent resident card as other students around Canada, those who arrived here in this year, to ensure that we are safe. We have been given all the necessary financial assistance, been given everything, accommodation, and any necessity plus a 4-year scholarship.
That's yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us, Yassine.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So now it's time for another break. Up next is arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
CITR's third annual DJ competition is almost upon us.
The party is at the Pit Pub at UBC on Thursday, November 12th.
We want DJs of all styles and genres to show off their mad skills. You don't have to be a UBC student, just a killer spinner. The competition is going to be judged by 5 of Vancouver's best DJs.
And yes, there will be prizes. That's right, it's a no-rules, free-for-all DJ fight to the death with killer prizes.
Well, actually, there are 3 rules.
1. You must send a demo to enter. It must be under 30 minutes long. Showcase your unique flavor, be original.
Get your submissions in right away to ensure your spot. Send an MP3 file to thatdjcontest2009@gmail.com or bring hard copies to the station located on the 2nd floor of the sub.
2. The DJ playing order is determined randomly.
3. Your score will be determined by 3 things: our judge's opinion, your pull, and the crowd response.
So get spinning, because CHR wants to showcase you at this year's DJ competition.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Okay. Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:51 and time for sports. And for that, here's Tyler Noble.
Thank you very much, Carrie. We start with the CIS Women's Rugby Nationals happening right here at UBC this weekend. Brittany Benn's 50-yard dash to the end zone against the flow of play got the number 2-seeded Guelph Griffins by an impassioned UBC Thunderbirds side by a score of 5-0 during round-robin play this afternoon. The win moves the Griffins into the semifinals tomorrow, while the host Thunderbirds will play for the 5th spot on Sunday against the Western Ontario Mustangs. UBC is the 6th seed in the tournament and controlled play for the majority of the match today, but could not translate that into points on the scoreboard. Neither team could really establish an effective attack, due in part to the muddy fields out at Thunderbird Park. Also out that way is the Canada West Men's Soccer Final Four Tournament. UBC takes on the Alberta Golden Bears at 7:30 tonight in the second semifinal match. Victoria and Trinity Western are going head-to-head in the other semi, happening right now. Trinity has already assured a spot in next week's CIS Nationals, as they are the host team this year. UBC hopes to be the other team to advance from the Canada West. The bronze medal match is tomorrow at 5 o'clock, and the gold medal game goes at 7:30. Meantime, the women's soccer team also battling for a spot in the Nationals at the Canada West Final Four in Langley. Trinity Western is hosting that conference showdown. UBC is taking on Victoria's in the semifinals there, and we'll have more on the results tonight on CITR Sports Friday. Still on the theme of championship action, the UBC women's field hockey team remains undefeated after day 2 at the CIS Nationals over on the island. The nation's most storied women's field hockey programs played to a goalless draw, those being the number 2-seeded UBC Thunderbirds and reigning national champion and host Victoria Vikes. In their match this morning, the duel marked the only outing of the day for the T-Birds, who beat top-ranked Guelph and Alberta by identical scores of 3-1 on Thursday. UBC plays the University of Toronto Varsity Blues tomorrow afternoon. In hockey, the UBC men's team looks to return to their winning ways as they host the Alberta Golden Bears this weekend at Thunderbird Arena. UBC is 3-2-1 after dropping a pair in Lethbridge 2 weeks ago. They had the bye last weekend, so extra time to prepare for the powerhouse Alberta Golden Bears. You can hear tonight's game right here on CITR with our pregame show with Jeff Sargent beginning at 7 p.m. The women's team, meanwhile, travels to Alberta with game 1 of their weekend set coming up at the top of the clock. And finally, women's basketball is at SFU tomorrow night following their home opener last Friday night against Trinity Western. A 7 p.m. start tomorrow night here on CITR. The men's team is off, and both volleyball teams have a bye week as well. With your Thunderbird Eye on Sports, I'm Tyler Noble.
Thanks, Tyler. And now with your weekend weather report, here's Denise Diadic.
Greetings on this wet Friday evening. It may be cold or blustery outside, but the lights on and off campus are twinkling cheerfully. The cold air aloft in the atmosphere has created an unstable air mass with numerous showers. This Friday night should include frequent showers with a risk of light hail and thunderstorms, low of 4 degrees. Saturday should be mostly the same, rain with a possibility of small hail, high of 10 degrees, low of 5. By Sunday, a stronger frontal system might approach the BC coast. By definition, a frontal system includes its own low-pressure zone, bringing foul weather such as low cloud, precipitation, or icing. But the bulk of the rain may hold out until Sunday night. High of 10 degrees, low of 6. This is your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Currently, it's 8 degrees and chilly at YVR. Cuddle up and drink some hot chocolate, cider, or other warm beverage of choice. Also, next weekend, we will be starting a weather trivia contest, so drag out your storm knowledge. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
Thanks, Denise. And that's our program for November 6, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 for another edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. For the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Hot Mess on 101.9 FM CITR.